Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Let's do it. I'm rolling on my end because I'm syncing today, and you look like you're where you need to be. Let's do the show.
All right.
Hello, everybody. I'm Kimberly Adams. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where we make today make sense.
I'm Kai Rizal. This is, of course, What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. We answer your questions that you want answers to. If you've got a question about the economy, your business, or tech, send it our way. We're at makemesmart@marketplace.org, or you can leave us a voicemail, 508-UB-SMART.
Our first question today comes from Frank in Massachusetts, who writes, can you explain why the market appeared to be cranky after the better-than-expected jobs report? I thought more jobs are always a good thing. Kai, you talked about this on the show. Go ahead.
Directly in this one? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So more jobs are always a good thing in the very important and critical how people are feeling and doing and being able to spend money in this economy, right? That is, it is hugely important. But what the stock market cares about most right now, and arguably all the time, but right now certainly, is what Jay Powell and the Federal Reserve think about the labor market. And Jay Powell and the Federal Reserve think the labor market is too hot, that there are too many open jobs for too many people. And when you have a jobs report come in like the November report came in last Friday with 263,000 new jobs, that was too much for the Fed. Okay. And well, actually, it was too much for Wall Street, too. But we'll get to the Fed in a minute. It was too much for Wall Street. And so Wall Street said to itself, oh, man, this means the Fed's going to keep on raising rates. Now, the Fed meets next Tuesday and Wednesday, 13th and 14th. And I will bet you money that Jay Powell in there at some point in that meeting will say, yes, the labor market is too darn hot, and we're worried about that, and that is why price stability is out of whack. Price stability is the way the Fed talks about inflation. So Wall Street saw the good jobs number, said, oh, my God, Jay Powell is going to keep raising rates, and thus the markets were cranky. That's the nutshell. Really.
I mean, this, I can very much imagine like this narrative of like, why is Wall Street, you know, which people associate with wealth and people who are not necessarily connected to our everyday existence, mad that people are getting jobs?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
Well, and so number one, yes. Number two, you could also make a case that, oh, my God, why is the Federal Reserve more worried about Wall Street than people on Main Street, right? And here's why the Fed pays attention to the market. What the Fed is trying to do when it raises interest rates, and I'm getting a little esoteric here, but bear with me. What the Fed is trying to do when it raises interest rates, it's trying to do something called tightening financial conditions, right? It wants the general market for money in this economy, because let's remember, that's what the Fed's all about, right? The price of money, that's what interest rates are. It wants the general market for money in this economy to become tighter. And when the stock market falls, people naturally, and you know, people, but also company people, stop spending as much money as they used to. And that's what the Fed wants to happen. They want to tighten those financial conditions, and so they're not upset about a falling market.
Okay.
So there you go. All right.
That was a very thorough answer.
Timothy in Pennsylvania, he's got a question about SPACs, if you remember those. Now that some time has passed since the SPAC craze, has anyone done a follow-up on how those companies have performed since going public?
In fact, people have. But just a reminder as to what a SPAC is, it's a special purpose acquisition company, which is basically a shell company that is solely created just to raise money from investors and then look for and acquire a private company, basically taking that company public, but without necessarily forcing that company to jump through all the hoops necessary if it were to do an IPO on its own. It's an easier and faster way for companies to go public, and there's less due diligence and all that jazz. So they were super trendy last year, but now not so much. And for a couple of reasons. Number one, the SEC started paying a lot closer attention to SPACs because they were starting to look real shady. And a lot of the SPACs listed during this boom were still looking for companies to buy to put under their umbrella. And so there's like a 2-year limit for how long these things can sort of like hang out and like look for acquisitions. And so a lot of SPACs listed during that time period might not meet that 2-year deadline. And at the same time, with inflation that high, this high as it's been, it's just not attractive to investors anymore. This idea that we're going to be like, oh, okay, I'm just going to throw money at you in hopes that you find a company that looks good enough to get people to buy it on the market when our SPAC launches, like the buzz around it is enough to just get people to buy on, which is an easy thing to do when interest rates are low and there's not really many places in the economy to get a high return on investment. And so people were a lot more willing to take, you know, risk and throw money at things that were not necessarily a sure thing. But that's just not the conditions that we're in anymore. Okay, so to the actual question that Timothy had about how they're performing. So we reached out to a couple of SPAC experts, including Dr. Michael Orogi from NYU Law and Dr. Michael Klossner from Stanford Law to see how they're doing. And they've been researching SPACs that completed a merger during the second half of 2020 all the way up through 2021. And what will probably not surprise anybody, they found that while the stock market has suffered in general during this period, SPACs have done worse. According to their research, the average SPAC has lost 62% of its initial value compared to traditional IPOs, which have just lost 36% of their value. Still not great, but, you know, very difference. Big difference in the numbers there.
Yeah.
And they said that the SPAC returns have continued to basically suck, which kind of matches their historical performance. What?
Yeah. How do you really feel about it?
I mean, okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, they have.
They said the SPAC returns have continued to be quite poor, which
matches. No, you had it right the first time. They've been terrible.
But that kind of lines up with how SPACs have performed over the last two decades. And, you know, there's a reason these things weren't super popular for a really long time until we ended up in this incredibly low interest rate environment that we saw, you know, in the last couple of years, and a lot more sort of, how shall we say it, willingness to take risk in the markets, especially by a lot of retail consumers who, frankly, many of whom were led astray by people who shouldn't have been talking about this stuff anyway. So there's that.
Exactly. That's the key part. Well, one of the key parts of this is that people got bamboozled because it was like, oh, free money. And it really wasn't. It really wasn't.
Yeah. So, and it's like, oh, this is the next big thing. Join this SPAC. And sometimes if you throw acronyms out there, it makes things sound way more interesting and important and legit than they are. And like, look, SPACs are a legit thing, but just because it sounds financy doesn't necessarily mean it's a good investment.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
All right. Next up, we've got a question from Aaron for you, Kai, and it's about your new electric vehicle. Here's the email. You mentioned you got an electric car and implied this will save you money because it would be cheaper to charge your car rather than fill up a gas tank. Is this because you have solar panels? How does this compare to other large appliances people power in their homes? And before you answer this question, I have a question too, because
yes, ma'am.
Your last car was a minivan and your new car is not, correct?
That is correct.
So I'm curious, like, that factoring into everything. Okay, go.
Oh, I don't know about, well, anyway, we'll get there.
Okay,
So, first of all, a lot of variables, right? A lot of variables. It's based on battery capacity, cost of electricity where I am, when you charge, whether it's, you know, peak or non-peak. Also, gas and electricity are both really expensive in California, so you got to take that into calculation. But generally speaking, charging an EV at home is less expensive than filling up a gas-powered car. And Courtney did the math on this one. So I'm getting an Ioniq 5, going in about half an hour to go pick it up because it takes like 6 weeks because there are supply chain problems. Mm. Getting an Ioniq 5, I've got a 2011 Toyota Sienna minivan. Courtney plugged all that information about both cars and the average price of electricity in California into LifeWire's EV savings calculator. And it says that if I drive 250 miles a week, which I don't actually, excuse me, I don't. So maybe I need to drive more. I don't know. but if I drive 250 miles a week, the calculator says I will save about $2,000 a year driving the EV instead of the minivan. And so that's a win. Also, it's better for the planet. That's why we're doing it, right? I mean, yes, I did spend $108 about a month ago filling up that car, and I was like, forget it. This is ridiculous. But it's just better for the planet. We got to get there. In terms of other household appliances, EVs use a lot. They've got huge batteries. They just take a lot of juice. Running a washing machine three times a week uses about 140 kilowatt hours of energy per year. EV charger uses about 4,900 kilowatt hours of energy per year. Those are estimates that Courtney got from Energy Sage. So look, it's a big deal, and you're making a transition, and there's a whole lot of stuff you have to learn about amps and kilowatt hours and all that stuff. But
did you have to learn all that stuff?
It's the thing to do. I have not yet learned it, but I will. I'm working on it.
Okay.
You know,
so you can make us smart about amps and kilowatt hours in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Yes, it's better for the planet. And I saw this really interesting, funny, entertaining, whatever ad, and I can't even remember which EV it was for, but it was basically like somebody trying to get past their EV anxiety. And the ad had them like on the therapist's couch. And the person was like, but I have range anxiety. Mm-hmm. And the therapist was like, do you drive more than 240 miles a day?
Exactly. Exactly. That's exactly right. That's exactly. You know? And look, it was a little hurdle for me and my wife. We're like, oh my God, what are we going to do? And then you're like, Jesus Christ, shut up. You know?
It's like,
and there are more EV charging stations
that
coming
much.
Online. Right. And there are, you know, there are maps in the car that will get you to the closest EV charger. I mean, it'll work out. We'll be fine.
Yes.
He says, with fingers crossed. All right, next up. A couple of weeks ago, Kimberly mentioned that her mom's house, Christmas decorations go up right after Halloween. Somebody called in about
on
that.
On Halloween.
Hi, this is Patrick calling from Mill Valley, California. And I think it would be great to have a deep dive on Kimberly's mom and her decorating. Heard about the overlap of Halloween and Christmas, which fascinated me. The trips to the haunted house sounded interesting, too. Love to hear it.
Oh, goodness. Right. Okay.
you take it from here, pal.
All right. So Courtney and Marissa actually called up my mom to talk about her decorating. And here's what she said.
I put up my Christmas decorations right after Halloween because I love Christmas, for one. And I find it very frustrating to put decorations up for 3 weeks, the massive amount of decorating that I do. So I want to enjoy it thoroughly. All my neighbors do it now, too. When they see me out there putting the yard, I have these gigantic yard fiber optic ornaments in my front yard as well. The next day, they're out there putting their stuff out. So now they're trying to keep up with me. So it's pretty cool.
So let me explain the scale of decorations that she's talking about. When she says giant fiber optic ornaments, these things are like 3 feet tall. Some of them, like, they're ornaments that are like the size of, I don't know, like what do you even compare it to? Like, and just like a small fridge. They light up. And so I'm out there running extension cords and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. As in, like, you can only carry them up one at a time from the basement. I would know because I carried up all of them. And they're very pretty, but it looks like someone scattered like giant, you know, size like 4A giant Christmas ornaments mm-hmm. all over the lawn. Mm-hmm. And then there are two separate nativity scenes. There are garlands, there's poinsettias, there's knickknacks, the bathrooms get decorated, the living room gets decorated, there's stuff that goes in the kitchen, there's stuff that goes in the front hallway, there's like little accents that go in the hallway. It's a lot of stuff. And so she wants it to last the season.
That's fair. I do have a logistics question. You said you carried it all up from the basement. So she keeps this all in the basement? She doesn't have like a separate storage locker for it all?
Yes. So she keeps it in the basement. She has a ranch. And so she keeps it in the basement. Although we just had a discussion about whether she should be keeping them in the garage moving forward. I'm not sure. Yeah, because like the navigating these giant ornaments around the like bend in the staircase was something.
Totally.
So who knows? We'll see what her storage strategy is in the coming year when she puts them away. She's typically pretty strict about getting them back in after Christmas. It's the before Christmas thing that's early lead up.
<That's>
Have you all put up your decorations yet?
So the outside decorations are up, and then we're waiting until the 15th when the three boys are home, and then we're doing everything on the 15th. So we'll have a good 10-day run before Christmas, and then the 2nd of January, everything comes down. That's my hard and fast rule. Time to move on.
Oh, wow. So that's just like 2 weeks of decorations.
Yeah. Usually we do it a little earlier, but I think consensus was that we would wait till the three boys got home from college.
Oh, that's nice.
I
put up my tree with a friend over the weekend, and I've got my garland up, and I've got a few more decorations to put up. I mean, it's like a one-bedroom apartment, so there's only so much you can do. But for happy hour on Friday, when we have our holiday party, I hope everybody will tell us about your decorations. And if you have any holiday-themed cocktails you want me to try out, I am actively soliciting recipes. And remember, I don't like gin. Gin is the devil. Okay, that is it for us today. And on this What Do You Want to Know Wednesday, we'll be back tomorrow for your Make Me Smart. We'll have some news fixes and a smiley. And again, don't forget our holiday edition of Economics on Tap this Friday. We will be live streaming on YouTube starting at 6:30 p.m. Eastern, 3:30 p.m. Pacific. And if you've got a holiday beer for Kai to try that's not too far outside his wheelhouse, never hurts to do that. I believe that, I know that you like to, like, keep things simple. I want to make sure that you have, like, things that you actually like. Okay, there we are. Send him our way.
Very simple man. Send them our way. You can do that at makemesmart@marketplace.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. 508-UB-SMART is how you do that.
It sounds like I'm trolling you, but I'm not, I swear.
No, you're not. I know you're not.
Make Me Smart is produced by Marissa Cabrera and Courtney Bergseeker. Ellen Rolfes writes our newsletter.
Today's show was engineered by Jake Cherry. Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. Bridger Bodner is working on Million Bazillion, or so we think. Francesca Levy is the executive director of Digital. I'm just saying.
I believe.
Show me an episode, Bridget. Show me an episode. That's all I'm saying. Of course, last time I made fun of her on here, by the way, she was actually listening, and so she hit me up on Slack, and she was like, I'm right here.
It's like, I can hear you, Kai.
I know. I'm just checking my Slack now. Ha! Got away with it.
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk, to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.